Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley.
Oh, yeah!
On 96.1 WSBT, the sports leader.
What is this?
We're talking Notre Dame football, the NFL, the Cubs, and more.
Oh, yeah, I like this idea.
The Leprechaun Lunch.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
With Sean Stiers.
All you do is dribble.
I have to dribble. If I give it to you, you just shoot.
And Evan Sharpley.
You're a chucker.
You chuck.
If it's happening in sports.
Bumble!
We're talking about it.
Flag on the play.
Now your hosts. Woo! Sean Stiers and former Irish quarterback. Evan Sharpley.
We're back in the saddle again. We're rolling. We're rolling. The Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley. We haven't been together for a couple of weeks. I was gone last week. You were gone the week before. So this is the first time in like 3 weeks that we've been together on the show, Evan.
Well, the boys are back in town.
Yeah, we're ready to go.
There you go. We'll both do bad singing to start the show.
Well, yeah, we'll sing.
Why not?
We'll sing. Yeah, why not?
That's right. Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley, presented by Bud Light Seltzer, locally distributed by United Beverage Company of South Bend, urging you to stay safe as we get back on track. And hopefully we get back on track. We'll try to get this show on track. We've got high school football coming up tonight, which is exciting.
You're not allowed to take Bud Light Seltzer to the game, are you?
No, you're not. Yeah. That's disappointing.
Probably not.
I can keep some cold ones in the fridge for when I get back from the game, I guess, tonight.
There we go.
And some other beverages. We've got Mishawaka against Marion. It should be an exciting one kicking off the season tonight. Our pregame show will start at 6:30, 7 o'clock kickoff here on WSBT. Marion was 12-2 last year. They went all the way to semi-state in 3A. They lost to eventual state champ Indianapolis Chatard. Their only other loss was to Mishawaka last year. At
a couple
Marion.
Of talented quarterbacks you're going to get to see play tonight, huh?
I tell you what, that is right. Maddox Begonia for Marion threw 20 touchdown passes last season and just 6 interceptions. He also ran for 13 touchdowns. And then for Mishawaka, who won a second consecutive sectional championship last year, Justin Fisher, as a sophomore starting quarterback, ran for 17 and over 1,200 yards. And I hear he's been working on the passing game a little bit this offseason too, Evan.
Yeah, a little bit. I've seen him probably about a half a dozen times. And, you know, he's got, you know, he's a specimen. You know, he's going to be tough to tackle. And within that Mishawaka offense, you know, I think he's going to be a good fit. They've got some other weapons as well. But, you know, one area that he wanted to work on was, you know, when they throw is to be able to make sure they take advantage of that. So he's done a nice job. I know he's camped at a couple of different places, you know, even though it was limited on where you could go and who you could throw in front of this summer. He went and did that. So, you know, I think he should be excited. And I've seen Maddox play too and talked with him and his family a little bit as well. He's starting to get some looks. You know, both guys are very, very talented as far as what they bring to the table from an athletic perspective. And as they continue to grow, I think for both of them, it's adding polish to the passing game. We both know they can run the ball and now kind of the next step is, can they be consistent throwing it as well?
Yeah, Justin Fisher, big, strong kid, quarterback. And again, first year as a starter, as a sophomore last year, so still just a junior. He's a baseball player as well, and it's going to be fun to watch him run that offense. And he's got a big fullback, Drew Mason, a pounding, physical kind of fireplug fullback behind him. He wrestles as well. I believe he won the NIC championship last year in wrestling. But they've got some athletes on the wings as well, and out at split in Milan Burris, Devon Parker. So should be an exciting one tonight. Both teams lost a lot on defense, but have a lot back on offense. You know, the notable guys, like we just talked about, the quarterback. So should be fun. 7 o'clock kickoff tonight. Pregame at 6:30. You'll hear from Mishawaka head coach Keith Kinder. And then there were some other games that ended up getting moved around in the last 36 hours.
First one to 50, I think, wins tonight.
I don't doubt that. It was only 15-6 last year, but it was pouring down rain.
I think it might be first to 50.
Yeah, it was pouring down rain over at Marion when these two teams played last year. Now they're opening up the season. I think you're right. I think there could be a ton of points scored out there tonight. You might have the call right there with first to 50. So we'll bring that up on the pregame tonight. Penn and Valpo moved their game to 12:30 tomorrow because both teams had some COVID issues come up this week. Penn was not able to practice either Wednesday or Thursday, so they're going to play tomorrow at Penn. And then South Bend St. Joe and Bremen both had their opponents have to cancel for tonight, so they're going to play each other tomorrow at Bremen. So good that they were able to work things out. And I know Chuck Freebie and Bob Nagel over at WHME, they're WHME 46 game of the week. I think they're on their third game of the week now because of some COVID cancellations. So they're going to end up with the Adams game tonight. So hopefully things go well over there. Everyone's adjusting on the fly, as we know, Evan.
It's all in flux the whole season. Who knows how it's going to go, but let's get it going.
That's right. And speaking of flux, We've obviously on Budweiser's Weekday Sports Beat, we've been following the situation at Notre Dame throughout this week since Father
Jenkins. I can't wait to talk about this.
Oh, my gosh. And it's like,
I'm so excited.
I think I've aged 10 years this week just following this situation, Evan. Mike, and I can't, what's it been like as an alum to kind of follow this just this week over at Notre Dame with everything that's
going on? Well, I mean, it's kind of been mixed emotions. I mean, you've got, Father Jenkins basically saying, you know, you're going to all online classes, which, let's be honest, I don't think taking the students out of the classroom was the issue. And then obviously,
no,
you know,
all this started apparently,
yeah,
because of kids going to off campus parties. Basically,
right.
So.
And then from there, I mean, there's been, you know, an opinion article in Notre Dame's on-campus newspaper, The Observer. You know, there's been some different things on TV as far as students voicing their opinion on, you know, not getting fair testing compared to, say, the football program. So there's a lot of different things that have gone on. But, you know, if we kind of backtrack and initially talk about this spike in cases, and, I mean, Sean, I think I've said it every week for the last 2 months. I mean, what did faculty and you know, those that are in high-powered, you know, positions think when they brought students back to campus? It is not a bubble. We've been saying this. It's a petri dish.
Yeah.
You are going to have outbreaks because what's going to happen is these students, and Darren brought this up last week, and now that I'm very mature now as a 33-year-old, but,
right.
You know, as a college student, I mean, sure, there's an off-campus party. You count me in. I mean, you know, this thing ain't going to bring me down. So,
yeah.
I think from a college perspective, I can understand, you know, why these things are happening. But what you have going on, Sean, and you brought this up, we've talked about it at length for the last, five, six months, there's a big monetary aspect to this. So, you know, if you don't attempt to bring the students back, what are you going to miss out on? You're going to miss out on tuition checks, 100%.
Right.
Because if you're going to go all online and you're going to tell, you know, Susie and John to stay in California or Florida or Texas or wherever they are and, you know, take classes virtually in their pajamas, you might say, you know what, I might take this year off and I'm not going to send in my tuition check. So I think, you know, the reality of it is, and I'm not trying to, this isn't something negative towards anybody. It is, you know, you still are trying to keep the doors open and, you know, professors, you know, they have an income that they're trying to and provide for their families as well. So there's a lot of different things at play here. But I think that was, you know, one of the driving factors of getting students back on campus was
absolutely
tuition and room and board.
Yeah.
But I think that maybe there was a little naivety in that there wasn't going to be a spike because you're trusting then students to be responsible, to not go to off-campus parties, to not congregate in large you know, in large air and small areas in large amounts. You know, there was a video posted on Twitter of the North or South dining hall, which is in a tent where no one's wearing masks and everyone's very close to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're putting a lot on the student athlete, or it's not the student athletes, but well, student athletes and students in general, to behave and, you know, follow guidelines, which whether they do that or not, we've seen they haven't done that. And you've seen a spike in testing. So you've got that going on.
Well,
you know, I think
in positive cases, I don't know
correct.
About testing, because again, that's one of the things that just following on like the Notre Dame subreddit and seeing some of the things that are being that students are sharing on social media, and even one of the reporters at WSB TV down the hallway at our studio, he's been following it and talking to some of these students who are going through the quarantine process and just some of the communication breakdowns. There's just so much going on over there right now. But I know that one of the early things, Evan, that some of the Notre Dame students were openly complaining about on social media was they wanted a test because they felt like they were at risk of being, that they might have been exposed. And look, I can't speak to what did and didn't happen early on, but testing has been a big thing across the country, that even though that more tests were available, they're still not as readily available as everyone would want. I think I've said here before, my wife is an RN and she's out in the community every day. And even though she knows that she's been exposed and has had coworkers who, you know, have you know, been positive for COVID, she still is not able to get a test because she has not been symptomatic enough to get a test, and knock on wood, she hasn't had it yet. But that's an issue that we're all dealing with, and hopefully the stories that popped up over the weekend about the NBA's bubble with the saliva test that they're doing down there, and the saliva test that was founded at Yale and they've used in the bubble, more rapid, you know, they're more rapid returns on the results, and you're able to administer a lot more of those tests a lot more quickly. That's kind of a big key in all of this, is getting those more readily available and being able to turn results around in minutes as opposed to days.
Yeah, I mean, if you can close the gap on that and obviously get it to the masses, you know, that's the big thing. You know, we talked a little bit about, you know what Notre Dame football was doing, and that was prior to the students even arriving to campus, was, you know, mass testing and doing it as often as possible. You know, so I think it's, I think it's a little interesting, you know, that's now coming more into play with the student body being on campus. I think it probably was safe to assume that was going to be the case. But I certainly can understand, you know, some of the sentiments from the general student population on wanting to be able to be tested more frequently.
Sure.
But at the same time, you know, the number of positive tests between athletes and the general student population, you know, it's interesting, right, for sure. But we also don't know who hasn't been tested or who wants to be tested. I think that, you know, if there's kind of, I've looked at it two different ways, you know, and I obviously brought up the part of tuition being involved and the monetary side of that as well. You know, had Notre Dame wanted to focus solely on the football aspect of things, I think the easy answer would have been, let's move all classes to online. But then you would have run the risk of, you know, certain families and individuals saying, well, we're going to sit this one out because we don't want to do the online side. But
yeah,
if you wanted the football aspect to work 100%, I think the no-brainer would have been to say, we're going to do all virtual classes, you know, for all fall sports and really for all varsity sports, I guess, for that matter.
Right.
You know, you move into an individual dorm. So football has their own dorm. You know, men's and women's basketball, they have their own dorm. Baseball and so and softball have their own dorm, cross country, lacrosse, hockey, you name it.
Yeah.
You know, athletes are the only ones that are on campus. Now, they're still taking online classes, but what you do then and what we've seen is what? The NHL hasn't had a positive test since they've moved into a bubble.
Correct.
The NBA hasn't had a positive test, and I'm not sure how long, but, you know, it's proven that if you're moving into that type of environment and you're limiting contact from the outside, your return to play, you're increasing the chances by a lot. And again, I keep repeating it, a college campus is not a bubble, it's a petri dish. I mean, it's
that's right.
I'm going to keep saying it. It isn't. So unless you're moving towards that and your goal ultimately is to play, I think there are going to be some barriers and there's some hurdles. Now, you know, initially it was, you know, Notre Dame was going to say, we're sending everybody home. Now, they pushed that off for 2 weeks to see if they could flatten the curve and bring some of those numbers down. But again, who are you relying on? You're relying on the student body.
Yes, who, 18 you know, to 22-year-olds, yes.
Whether 50% of them or not think that they're invincible, I did. I'm sure that
we
most
all
of, yeah. We all did. I mean, it's you know, that's so that's kind of the reality that we're living in. So again, what do we say? Every week, we're cautiously optimistic, but you know, if the trend continues and they go back to in-person classes, now again, the in-person classes are not the issue. It's the off-campus parties, it's the gatherings, etc., where you know there's a problem. So you're seeing a push from you know some of the athletes, Ian Book being one of them, on you know some of his social media accounts of, hey, let's wear masks and save Notre Dame football. You know, I don't know how much you
what
know,
else
how
can
much
you do?
Positive feedback you'll get maybe. Right, from the general student population. So, you know, where I sit right now, Sean, is I wouldn't be surprised if students get sent home in the next couple of weeks. I wouldn't be surprised at all. But I think that if that's the case, it bodes well for Notre Dame football to play because then you have a campus free of the general student population, correct? And you have now mainly athletes who you could quarantine and you could put into a bubble where they'd be able to, you know, they're around the same people they've been around since June is what it would be.
Right. And like-minded people they've been around since June because of when you look at the clean slate that the football team had through the, you know, the end of June when they reported they had a couple cases, but then they went until the students came back. They were spotless after that. They had a couple positive tests when guys reported, but then they were spotless after that. And now the release that they had yesterday, 5 players tested positive and 6 others also quarantined because of contact tracing. And I also want to go ahead and mention right here, Evan, that Notre Dame on its COVID dashboard updates that every day at noon. So they updated that right after we began the show yesterday. Okay, so let's just reel it back a little bit. Tuesday, when Father Jenkins made the announcement, they had 147 positive cases of COVID on campus. Wednesday, it was up to 222. As of yesterday, 304. In their latest update on the COVID dashboard, it is now up to 336. So they had 32 more cases in the last 24 hours between yesterday and today. And we don't know if that includes more football players. 2,035 total tests have been administered. As of yesterday, the football team had 5 positive tests, and they were administering more tests today. Now, I don't know if they have, you know, like access to those saliva tests that we were talking about yet, but I know that what you were alluding to, what you were saying earlier, that they are now doing more random testing of both faculty and students to try to, you know, increase the likelihood of cutting this down. But just what you were saying there a second ago about if you send the students home and you're doing online testing, because Mac Brown was saying this at North Carolina the other day, the football coach at North Carolina, they sent the students home. The football team is still on campus. And Mac Brown is saying, hey, we've got a bubble now because we don't have to worry about the.
And guess what? They'll play then. It'll work.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So my question to you, because there's obviously, you know, this is kind of a double-edged sword. Would you be okay, again, as a former player, would you be okay if the student body is home and they're taking their classes online and you're a football player or whatever sport you happen to be, you're on campus, you're also taking your classes online. So you happen to be practicing for football but on campus, but the rest of the student body is home, but everyone's taking the classes online in the same way. Would you be okay with that?
If it means I can play football, I'm doing it. And the thing is, if I'm part of the general student population, I'm probably not pleased, but I think it has to happen. I mean, we're at 336 confirmed cases since August 3rd. So that's, 3 weeks of being on campus, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. We hadn't had any positive tests within the football program until recently. And guess what? That's because probably some of those guys, hey, I'm sitting third string here, I'm probably not going to play this year, right? Okay.
Right.
I'm going to go to this party. Now, you better believe that most of the guys that have been around the program for a few years get it and they want to play. So, today is a Friday. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Sean, I could easily see these total confirmed cases, especially if the number of tests go up, be at 500 by Monday or Tuesday.
What are you trying to do to me, Evan?
I'm not trying to do anything. What I'm saying is...
No, I know what you're saying.
I think if I'm reading the writing on the wall, because I still think that with the ACC moving forward and saying that we're still trying to play football games, and John Swofford said that today, I believe that these students, the general student population, is going to be sent home. I believe that the varsity student athletes are going to stay on campus. I think it's going to be all virtual learning, and I still think we're going to see football games this fall. That's where I'm sitting right now.
Really? Okay. So you still think we're on track for that? Even with the cases going up, you still think that they're going to do everything they can to make a football season happen for both Notre Dame and the ACC?
I think they're going to do their best to make that happen.
Okay.
And much like Mack Brown at North Carolina, if the student population is gone, you do have a bubble. You do have protection.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's much easier to, administer tests. And, there's obviously some negative publicity right now where you have student athletes seemingly getting better treatment than the general, student population because they have access to the testing protocols set up, prior to the general student population getting back to campus. That was part of it, is if we want to return to play, there has to be increased testing. And what's, I guess what's very interesting is if you look at the total number of players on Notre Dame football team where there were zero positive tests, now the student population comes back and there's a spike. Okay, well, let's not point the finger, but let's point the finger a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Let me ask you this. Is it realistic at all to think that a campus of 9,000-10,000 plus students, faculty, employees who are living in close quarters can go 4 months, between now and November without more outbreaks, even if they're able to somehow get this under control in the next 2 weeks, the September 2nd date that they have that's the length of the plan to go online and see if they can curb it?
No.
Yeah. I don't think so either.
I don't think so either.
Because, and at some point, because they've had this plan, and again, the number now is up to,
336.
Yeah, the number's up to 336. Just the act right now of trying to quarantine them, and as you said, if the number continues to rise at the rate they're at over the weekend, because on Tuesday it was 147, so now you're up almost 200 in a span of 3 days. That's where they've gone in that time. They've done over 2,000 tests now at this point. I don't know how you can hope to do that with all the residents, the residence halls and everything else. I don't know how there's any hope that can happen.
But they still are going to play football, Sean. They're going to play football, I think.
Okay. Evan Sharpley says they're still playing.
Even though, we rewind a couple months, it was, we're not playing unless students are on campus. as we've learned, you know, there are new developments every day. This is in flux. It's a very fluid situation. So I think at this point, you know, that the brass at Notre Dame have to look at, okay, we've got to look at and consider the health and safety of our student body. But if we are able to put together a type of environment that allows that to happen for a revenue generating sport, I think we should consider it. Would be how I think that conversation would go.
Because they have said before that the students have to be on campus for them to play. That's been Notre Dame's stance in the past. But
again, I think that partially that gets back to, and that's kind of what we led off with, is, I mean, a tuition check. I mean, what is tuition at Notre Dame right now? You know, yeah. 70 to 80 grand with room and board and books and whatnot. I mean, that's a big chunk. So I got to imagine, though, if they do send the students back and there is virtual learning only, you know, there's going to have to be a discussion on, and I'm thinking of this more, well, less from an athlete perspective and more from the general student population on, am I going to get a refund? you know, is what does that look like even maybe, you know, the following year? Is there maybe a decrease Sure. in overall tuition or a decrease in room and board? I think that some of those things are going to have to be on the table.
And it's a conversation that's going on all over the country.
Yeah, everywhere.
At all these schools. Yeah, because I saw there was on one of the news shows, they were talking about that, I think, last weekend, that's a topic of conversation. And from the school's perspective, I think the bottom line is you're still getting these courses. I've never taken a course online. I know that obviously in today's world, especially master's programs and things like that, a lot more coursework is done online. Have you ever taken an online class by any chance?
Yeah,
difference in your ability to learn. What, you know, how would you compare it?
I mean, you know, I took an online class that was, I mean, it was fully online. You know, we didn't have Zoom conferences where you had any face-to-face. And I know, because I've actually been part of and spoken a couple of business classes at Notre Dame late in the spring and then also in the summer during summer classes too, where it's not in person, but, you know, with technology, you know, you are seeing face-to-face. Now, the master's courses I took, and I took those while I was playing pro baseball, I never saw a face, not once.
Huh.
And got a master's degree. I think it's, you know, it's obviously it's changed a little bit. You want to have that connection with, here's who my professor is, here's his face, here's her face, you know, here's my student population.
Right.
They're there. So I think it's morphed a little bit. And in that regard, I think it makes it more personal. You know, I mean, I was talking with people all across the country, but I never know what they looked like, what they sounded like, anything like that. So it certainly has adapted through this entire situation.
Well, and I think one of the things, and, you know, not having gone to school at Notre Dame, but I went to a big state school. So there were plenty of times where I was in a lecture hall with 200 to 500 people, you know, and Notre Dame, part of what they do, you know, the fact that you do have better student to teacher rate, you know, professor to student ratio and all of that kind of stuff with smaller class sizes. But at big state schools, I mean, there are plenty of massive lecture halls, and I don't know that there's necessarily a benefit to being in a big room like that 200 feet away from your professor as to sitting right in front of a computer, you know, basically being able to get the same information. I just don't, you know, I can see it both ways, but you know, just where we are right now, I think so many people are, especially over the last 5 months, have become more adept and more used to using their computers for things that I don't know that there's a massive difference anymore. All right, we're coming up on 12:30. Let's get a break out of the way. When we come back, we have some more specific Notre Dame football type things. We'll shift the conversation to actual football. Got some news about season tickets at Notre Dame, season ticket holders information. We've got a little bit of word on that. We've got some comments from Brian Kelly. Seems like a year ago, but earlier this week he did one of his Zoom conferences before all of this extra COVID stuff started happening just over the last 3 or 4 days. He's Evan Sharpley. I'm Sean Steyers. Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley, presented by Bud Light Seltzer and Sports Radio 96.1 WSBT. Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley. He's Evan Sharpley. I'm Sean Steyers. We are presented by Bud Light Seltzer, distributed by United Beverage Company of South Bend. Glad to have you with us. And again, don't forget Mishawaka versus Marion coming up tonight. Kickoff at 7 o'clock here on Sports Radio 96.1 WSBT. Vince D'Addario and I will have the pregame from Steel Stadium at 6:30. We'll be doing Budweiser's weekday sports meet at the stadium this afternoon, beginning at 4 o'clock, with plenty of things to talk about. If you joined us late, unfortunately, through Notre Dame's, the university's COVID dashboard, they are now reporting 336 total cases of COVID-19. That is up from 304 confirmed cases yesterday and 147 cases on Tuesday. So it continues to rise. Well, Evan, this is far from surprising news, but a Notre Dame season ticket holder has told WSBT that the Notre Dame ticket office informed him that the only people who will be allowed at Notre Dame Stadium for games this season will be students, faculty, staff, and parents of players on the football team. Otherwise, season ticket holders will not be able to attend Notre Dame home games this season. Again, that's what a season ticket holder told us he's been told by the Notre Dame ticket office. So that they are preparing for that at least reduced capacity. Again, not overly surprising at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a release I saw earlier today. That's kind of across the board right now. I mean, some places are looking at still trying to do 20%. It's been laughable on a couple occasions on they're still trying to tailgate.
And
you're going to have your own area. Please try to social distance and keep your space. You know, in a tailgating setting, and I've been to many tailgating settings, Sean, there's not a lot of social distancing going on.
I don't see much either. Not at all. Not at all. Well, if the season is played, it's looking like Notre Dame is going to add South Florida to the schedule this season. Multiple reports, including Irish Illustrated, saying that USF is going to replace Western Michigan as the plus one on the schedule. That game would be September 19th at Notre Dame Stadium. And of course, the only previous meeting between the two teams came in 2011, when Lou Holtz's son Skip led the USF Bulls to an upset of the Fighting Irish. Were you there that day?
No.
You were not there?
No, I was not.
Do you remember besides the fact that Notre Dame lost to USF and Skip Holtz, do you remember possibly what might have happened in the middle of that game?
No.
Big thunderstorm.
Oh.
And it delayed, like halftime ended up being like an hour and a half or something like that, at least an hour and a half, I think. There was a long delay at halftime because of a major thunderstorm, and I believe the stadium might even, you know, had to have been evacuated. Like, people had to go, like, down into, you know, the bowels of the stadium and all that, the concourse areas and all that kind of stuff. So it was a long day, and Notre Dame ended up getting upset, and that was the long fumble return for a touchdown and all that stuff. A day to forget as far as Notre Dame goes. So that's the only previous meeting between the two. But of note, Charlie Weiss Jr. is the offensive coordinator now at USF after a couple of years with Lane Kiffin at FAU.
Yeah. Well, and here's, you know, if you want to know the reason why I wasn't paying attention to that, is I was playing in the playoffs against the Spokane Indians.
Hey!
When I was with the Everett Aqua Sox, so.
Everett Aqua Sox.
Yeah, that was what was going on, I believe.
All right. I buy that as an excuse. That's right. I couldn't remember what your timeline was, so you were still playing professional
baseball. I'm trying to put this together. Maybe I wasn't. No, I might have not been. I might have been with a different team at that point, but okay. The Aqua Sox were in the playoffs at that point, but my name's not there, so we got to look somewhere else.
All right.
I think I probably was playing it just outside of Cleveland. That makes more sense.
Okay. Well, you were at Notre Dame when Charlie Weiss was still there.
I was, yeah, and I know Charlie Jr.
Okay.
And he's now one of the youngest offensive coordinators in college football.
26 years old.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I've always liked Charlie Jr. You know, he's a and similar, you know, to his dad as far as a student of the game, you know, was always around it and loved it. And he's done a nice job of being around some programs. And I know he got into coaching at a very young age. I mean, mm-hmm. he did some coaching right out of high school.
Yeah, I think he was on Charlie Senior's staff at Kansas, or, you know, in some fashion mm-hmm. or another, you know, like a grad assistant or something like that. But, yeah. He's been plugging. Did you see anything back then that said, oh, this guy's going to end up being a coach too? Any football aptitude, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, him and his dad are both smart guys.
Oh, yeah.
You know, neither of them were great athletes, and I think that they admitted to that. you know, it was always funny seeing, you know, Coach Weiss out there trying to show us how to run a route. You know, this probably not the best guy to show us how to do it. Now,
sure.
To design an offense, you know, another story. You know, his son, I think, you know, more athletic than he was. But at the same time, you know, I think, you know, what their gift is certainly their mind and understanding how offenses and defenses work. And, you know, trying to align players in situations that can do that. And, you know, I've talked with Charlie Jr. a little bit, just, you know, kind of in the recruiting side of things with some, you know, guys that I had worked with and some guys that had gotten, you know, he had a little bit of interest here locally and possibly recruiting them. So, you know, we touched base over the last couple of years and, you know, it's been cool to see his development and really his rise at such a young age.
Yeah.
But, you know, he did the right thing. I mean, I think he realized early on that, you know, the athletic side wasn't for him. And he fully immersed himself in the coaching side and understanding and then also, too, learning from some guys that have been in the business for a while and now getting plugged in there, I think, has been a good thing.
Yeah, and again, he was on Lane Kiffin's staff at Florida Atlantic, didn't go with Lane to Ole Miss, but now the offensive coordinator at USF South Florida. Their head coach is Jeff Scott, who was Clemson's offensive coordinator for 10 years, first-time head coach. So that's potentially coming up September 19th if Notre Dame does indeed end up filling its schedule with South Florida. All right, a few things from Brian Kelly that we heard. One, an update on Kevin Austin, who injured his foot, broke the fifth metatarsal in his foot on July 29th, had foot surgery. And here's Brian Kelly from his Zoom press conference giving a timeline and everything going on with Kevin Austin right now.
Well, I think we've got a great culture in there. You know, obviously having Tom in there with those guys, you know, makes it for you know, a very good situation because he played here. He can drive that cart all over the place. I think he's a really good driver. You know, obviously, kidding aside, you know, he's non-weight bearing at this point. So, you know, his first 4 weeks is non-weight bearing. And then, you know, he'll be able to put some weight on it. And, you know, again, it's you know, anywhere from 8 to 12 weeks, depending on how he heals. You know, Kevin's been really good. He's got a great attitude. And, you know, I think he's taking all the things that he needs to do at this time to heart in terms of, you know, doing the little things to get him ahead of the game, you know, bone stem, all of those things. But he's got to be off his feet for the first 4 weeks, and then we can begin some form of rehab program for him.
You ever broken a bone in your foot, Evan?
I had a stress fracture in high school, but not a full break.
Yeah. So that's the update on Kevin Austin. And if it's 8 weeks, like 8 to 12 weeks is what he's talking about for recovery. 8 weeks is the end of September. 12 weeks would be around like October 24th would potentially be when he might be able to come back when Notre Dame visits Pittsburgh. And man, it's just like, I think we talked about this before. Bonzi Colson had the same kind of injury. He tried to come back. And now everyone's different, of course, but he ended up re-injuring it and then, you know, it went through another lengthy process trying to get healthy again, trying to start his professional basketball career. So I don't know. I don't think that I would be in necessarily a huge hurry if I was Kevin Austin. I think maybe some of it would depend on the situation with the football team, how it's looking, and all that kind of stuff. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, at this point now, I mean, there's still a lot of, you know, question marks in the air. You want to make sure you get that thing right. You know, if you rush it back, you know, it's not, there's not a lot of great things that can happen. So, you know, go through the rehab process, you know, make sure that you're listening to the doctors and those that are giving the advice. And once you're finally cleared, then get back out there. But there's, you know, I don't think you need to rush to it.
Yeah. Completely agree with that. So with Kevin Austin out, what's this wide receiver situation looking like? Who is emerging at wide receiver? Here's what Brian Kelly says about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a team game. I mean, I don't know that we've ever had a situation where, you know, when we lost Boykin, it was like, all right, who's going to step up? When we lost Fuller, who's going to step up? Every year, you know, we have guys that can step up and make plays for us. And this will be, you know, different, you know. We know Kevin Austin's out for a little bit, but, you know, I think, you know, McKinley's going to make plays for us. You know, Ben Skoranek, you know, a fifth-year transfer is going to come in and make plays for us. Avery Davis is a veteran who's going to make plays for us. So I think there's a lot of guys that will step up. The tight ends, you know, you lose, you know, a great tight end. And it seems like we've got Tommy Tremble and Brock Wright, Meyer and Bowman, George Takis. So, you know, the tight end wide receiving core, every year we talk about guys, you know, moving on. And that's what we want, right? We want to recruit really good players, develop them. They have great years. But we just think it's, you know, another year where guys are going to step up and make plays for us. And it won't just be one. It never is. One guy may be the big playmaker again, but we think we've got a lot of depth at the position that can definitely step up and make plays for us.
There's depth there, Evan, but with the exception probably of Braden Lindsay, who I don't think really came up there, he's the downfield guy, and Kevin Austin stood to be that other guy who could stretch it a little bit. Are you concerned that, you know, with that, when you lose a dynamic guy, there are bodies there, but when you lose a dynamic guy like Austin, what it could look like?
Well, you never want to lose a talent like that, right? But, you know, and Darren brought this up and asked me the question last week, and you talk about a guy like Ben, you know, as a grad transfer, and even, you know, McKinley, too, who's been in the program for a while, that could fill that space on the backside as a possession guy. You know, maybe not as dynamic, but, you know, I think that we'll still bring a good skill set. What I say trumps all of that is having a guy like Ian Book. So regardless of, you know, who's out there, I think that he's going to make the entire receiving crew, albeit still fairly inexperienced, I think he's going to make them better just by his knowledge and his understanding, his maturity in this offense. I think that it's going to be, I think that that's going to trump losing, you know, a talent like that. Now, again, you still want that guy on the field. That's not to say that, but I think just with what you're getting in Ian Book, now I'd be more concerned if we're talking about a first-year starter, Sean, you know, if we're talking about a guy who's filling Ian Book's shoes and you've got an inexperienced wide receiver group and now you've got a talent like that go down, I'd be more concerned. But right now, as I sit here and talk to you, with my confidence in Ian Book as the quarterback, I'm not as concerned with Kevin Austin not out there. I think that they're still going to be just fine.
What about a freshman like Jordan Johnson, whose name has come up quite a bit? It's a pretty highly touted kid, and we've seen him make some plays in some of the practice videos Notre Dame has been sharing this week. What do you see, even for a talented guy, a guy with a lot of talent? He's got size, he's got speed, it looks like he's got good hands. For a freshman receiver to come in and make impact, what do you think is the biggest challenge for him?
Learning the playbook. I mean, that's it. I mean, you know, understanding where your hots and sights are. You know, if you've got a blitz to your side, you know, whether it's a linebacker or a secondary blitzer, what does that mean to your route conversions, you know, when coverages change, because that happens. You know, it's different in high school. A lot of times, you know, programs, they line up what they line up in, you know, that's what you're getting. If you got two high safeties, and you can get away with your athleticism, even if maybe you run the wrong route. You know, when you get into college, you know, there's a lot of rotation that happens at the snap of the football. You know, a safety rotating down in the box, maybe a drop end, you know, if they're playing some type of blitz zone. And if you aren't getting a number of reps, and, you know, Notre Dame has lost out on spring for their early enrollee guys, you know, you lose out a portion of the summer, and now you have a expedited, unique fall camp.
Yeah.
You know, you could be a little bit behind the eight ball as a young player, and there's, you know, that's not your fault. There's nothing really you can do that's within your control, because there is reading the playbook, and then there is understanding the playbook while you're on the field. Those are two very different things. You know, you have to be able to translate what you're doing in the classroom and watching on film onto the football field. And the guys that are able to play, you know, they're the ones that can do that the quickest. But I will say this, you know, if you have a skill set that is maybe more advanced than somebody in your same grade or even an upperclassman, and that can be size, that can be speed, that can be, you know, vertical leap, mm-hmm. You've got to believe that the coaching staff is still going to find ways to try to highlight those skills and utilize them. I think the example I've used ad nauseum on this show is, you know, Golden Tate as a freshman didn't really know the playbook, but dang was he fast, and right. If you threw the ball toward him, he was either going to catch it or it was going to be an incomplete pass. You know, so what we did is we would line him up to our sideline so that the coaching staff could tell him what route he needed to run based on the coverage, and if there was going to be an adjustment, then they could help him out. But to his credit, right, as I've said many times, you know, he did learn the playbook, and he became the complete package as understanding what defenses were trying to do and how he could combat that on the offensive side. And then you take into consideration his natural athletic ability, and you have Golden Tate and you have Michael Floyd. I mean, yeah. That's what you get, right?
Exactly.
So what I would say is the biggest hurdle is just understanding the offense and being able to adjust to what defenses do at the college level, because it's much different than you get in high school.
All right. He's Evan Sharpley. I'm Sean Stiers. Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley. We'll take our final time out. When we come back, Joe Montana sounding off on Rudy, the unwritten rules of baseball, and some more Trevor Bauer drama if we get a chance. We're presented by Bud Light Seltzer, locally distributed by United Beverage Company of South Bend, urging you to stay safe as we get back on track. Sports Radio 96.1 WSBT. Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley, presented by Bud Seltzer on Sports Radio 96.1 WSBT. Got just a few minutes here before we have to wrap things up today. Evan, Joe Montana recently interviewed with, he did an interview with Barstool Sports. Here's what he said about the movie Rudy. Quote, "Was there a lot of things that happened? Yeah, he got in. He got a sack. Was the crowd chanting? No. Did I throw in my jersey? No. Did he get carried off the field? He got carried off by three of the biggest pranksters on the team." End quote. That's from Joe Montana. So
love it. I always love Joe. Thanks, Joe, for that one.
What is Evan Sharpley's take on all of it? Have we discussed Rudy on this show before?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Okay, so I've had Rudy on my show a couple times on the game day show on WSBT. And, you know, I had heard some nightmare stories prior to him being on the show. And I got to be honest with you, I had a great experience with Rudy interviewing him. Now, I will say, as far as what Joe is saying about the actual movie, I've heard that a number of times. It's a great Hollywood movie, but not very much of it is true. So I get it, you know, and Rudy did a great job of selling it to the Hollywood execs and getting a movie made, but it's not very factual.
But in Notre Dame circles, you know, like the people who, you know, were close to the, you know, either on that team like Joe, people who have covered it, who know this, know that, everybody gets so hung up on that. And we've got the Two Guys Talking Sports Movies podcast, and we talk about this a lot when we talk about based on true stories. Hollywood is always going to Hollywoodize things. Like the general storyline is there. I mean, it was a guy who came from Joliet, couldn't get into Notre Dame. He went to Holy Cross and got grades. He got into Notre Dame eventually. He walked on the football team. He played in a game at the end of his career. All those things actually happened. And it doesn't matter what based on a true story movie we're talking about. Friday Night Lights is the same way, since we're in the sports genre. You know, there are things that did and didn't happen that are portrayed in the movie. It always happens. And I think the closer you are to the story and the more you know, that's who gets worked up, you know. And I think that some people just can't get past that with Rudy for some reason.
Yeah, we watched it during fall camp. The lights were off, and then the lights turned on, and Rudy came down.
There you go. And, I mean, they still watch it at the beginning of this. You know, when the students come back, they put it up there on the big screen in the stadium, which is
Vince Vaughn,
cool thing.
John Favreau. You know, I mean, those are the two stars of the show right there.
Swingers, double down Trent. There you go.
That's right. Always double down.
That's right. That's right. Fernando Tatis, the unwritten rules of baseball, swung on a 3-0 count, hit a grand slam. Who writes the unwritten rules, first of all? And as a guy who did, you talked earlier in the show, you played professional baseball as well as football at Notre Dame. What do you think about all this uproar about that?
I saw something great. It was the paper that these unwritten rules are written on or unwritten on isn't even worth what it's written on or unwritten on. Yeah, so I love what Tatis is doing. I mean, I think right now in an environment where baseball fans are traditionally the viewing age is getting older, probably don't like it, but you know, Trevor Bauer sounded off on it too and kind of encouraged Tatis to keep doing those things.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, all of my hitters that I work with, you know, as long as their coaching staff's okay with it, 3-0 is a green light. And we saw it recently too. I mean, a team's up 7-0 and then is down 9-7. You keep scoring until you cannot score anymore.
It's funny that after all this uproar about the unwritten rules, because the Padres were up by 7 just last night, the Blue Jays, the Phillies scored 7 runs in the first inning. They ended up losing because the Blue Jays scored 7 runs in the 6th inning of a 7-inning game. And that, you know, that's another thing. It was a 7-inning game because of these 7-inning doubleheaders. The Blue Jays came back and won when they were down by the same amount of runs late in the game. I mean, how do you tell a hitter to stop swinging the bat? That's what I don't get.
You shouldn't.
No matter how much you're up or down, you can't tell a hitter to give away an at-bat just because of what the score happens.
You know what you do is you tell the pitcher to be better and not give up 14 runs or, you know, however many they end up giving up. I mean, be better on that. Don't get mad because you give up a grand slam 3-0. You know, don't be mad at that.
I mean, it's 3-0 because the pitcher couldn't throw. He threw 3 balls to begin with.
And there's three guys on base too. I mean,
and
there's obviously
a
reason.
Eric Hosmer hit a grand slam for the Padres last night. It's their 4th straight game with a grand slam. Ties a major league record. The streak began with Tatis's grand slam early.
Chicks
in the week.
Dig the long ball, baby.
That's right, baby.
You know it.
That's
you
right.
Know it.
That's right. Hey, good stuff as always, Evan. You have a good weekend. We'll talk to you next
week. You too. See ya.
Sounds good. Evan Sharpley, Leprechaun Lunch with Sean and Sharpley. We're presented by Bud Light Seltzer and United Beverage, urging you to stay safe as we get back on track. Don't forget, Mishawaka versus Marion football, 7 o'clock tonight, Sports Radio 96.1 WSBT South Bend.